Okay. You are Nancy Tucker Barnes. You are my mother. You were born February 25th, 1944. It's now December 8th, 2018. So today you are 74. We are in Fairfax, California in Marin County. I am John Lockhart, your son, and I'm 50 this year. You were born in the last year of World War II. You started a family in the midst of the civil rights crisis in 1968, and you became a grandmother close to the turn of the century in 1998. So I want to get into that whole period of time. What's your earliest memory as a child?
My earliest memory is when I was 2 years old. I was exploring out behind my house in Needham, Massachusetts, and I found a treasure, which turned out to actually be a dead rat. And I picked it up by the tail and took it home.
But you didn't know it was dead.
I didn't know it was dead. And showed my mother, look what I found. And I remember being very proud. And she explained to me that it was dead. And
how did she react when you first showed her?
A little bit horrified.
Okay.
Mainly because back then people thought rats carried diseases, which is probably true. And so she was a little bit...
Especially dead rats.
Yes, concerned that I was carrying this thing. But she explained to me what dead was and that it wasn't going to move, and we decided to bury it. And I distinctly remember burying it in a donut box. The kind of donuts that had powdered sugar on them. And so the rat actually got covered in powdered sugar, and we dug a hole in the backyard and we buried the whole thing.
Doesn't sound like a bad way to go.
In powdered sugar, no, not a bad way to go.
It sounds like even though she had the obvious kind of horrified reaction any parent might, it sounds like she handled it pretty well, and you learned a nice lesson from it that wasn't scary or traumatic.
That's very true.
All right.
I was still very proud that I had found it.
So speaking of your parents, you grew up in the Boston, Massachusetts area. Your father, Art, was a doctor, an OBGYN. And your mother, Martha, I believe she was college educated, but what did she do for a career? I don't know exactly.
Well, she attended Wheaton College, actually at a very young age, at 16, and finished at Boston University. And in those days, in the early 40s, even when the war was over, which I think was 45, I would have been one. Men really didn't like their women to work. The women had worked
including
as riveters during the war.
Right.
And after the war, it was like...
Time to go back home.
Yes, time to go home and be a housewife.
And your father ascribed to that.
He did. And I think it was also thought at the time that the man was the provider,
mm-hmm.
and the woman was the housewife and took care
mm-hmm.
of the children. So even though my mom was college educated and really very, very bright, she was stuck at home. And by the time I was about three, we had moved to a large farmhouse still in Needham, Massachusetts. And she got really kind of weird. I won't say she had a nervous breakdown, but she got afraid to go outside and sort of claustrophobic and didn't want to stay in the house, but was afraid to go outside. And a friend of my father's befriended her. He was also a doctor. And he said, Martha, you really need to get a job. And he got in contact with Dr. Papanicolaou in New York City, who invented the pap smear, which
wow.
is, and she actually arranged to go and study under him, and that's called cytology, the study of cells, and she became a cytologist, and she set up her own business with many of my father's friends, maybe five or six other OBGYNs, and they would do this pap smear. And you put the slide with the cells on it into alcohol or ethanol, and she would go in her car and pick them up and take them to her little lab that she set up, and she would stain them and read them under the microscope and be able to write a report of whether she saw cervical cancer or not in the patient. And then she would give those back to the doctors. It took about a week. So she would do her rounds every week and then stain the slides and read them and give the reports. And you can't even do that today. Today you have to work in a hospital and be under a pathologist who's an MD. And when that rule came into being, she had already done this job for maybe 20 or 25 years. And a friend of my father's who was a pathologist said, "Martha, you are better at this than even I am, even though I'm a pathologist. You've been doing it for years, but I'm going to sign your papers for the government or the medical board or licensing, whatever she, yeah, the licensing thing. So I will be your mentor and you can work under me, but just go back and do what you were doing because you're better at it than I am." And she actually did that for her whole career.
How long?
I think, you know, my dad stopped delivering babies when he was 60 and he retired around 65. And she probably stopped doing that maybe in her late 50s.
So 30 plus years.
30 plus years.
And was your dad supportive after all?
Yes.
Must have been for that long.
Absolutely. You know, things had changed, times had changed, and, you know, he was really very proud of her. And even though he was an OBGYN, he took pap smears and he read slides and, you know, he really was proud of what she was doing and he respected her highly for her knowledge.
So what's fascinating to me then is that in the 40s, in the mid 40s, at a time post-war when women were moving back into the home and certainly were discouraged from being in the workplace if they had families or were married, your mother not only was an entrepreneur and opened her own business, but in a science field for a woman at the time.
Yes, very unusual.
I think that's fascinating. You had a somewhat difficult relationship with your parents growing up, and to some extent for the rest of their lives. Tell me about that.
Well, my mother, at the time when my dad was training to be an OBGYN, the residents were very rarely allowed even out of the hospital. It was basically a 24-hour job. And when he became a doctor and set up his own practice, he never took on a partner. So he had a friend that would cover for him a month in the summer, and he would do the same for that friend. He happened to be named Dr. Brown. And so he only had a month off a year. And when you deliver babies, it's any time of day or night. And if you're the only doctor, you're gone. So my mom was the more of a disciplinarian than she was a nurturer.
Mm-hmm. And, by necessity, you think?
Well, she had two little girls that never did anything wrong, hardly. we were basically on show and passed things around at cocktail parties. And, you know, neither of us got into any kind of trouble, basically. But she was very strict, and so just by nature, she was more of a disciplinarian. She had grown up herself with a very strict father, and I think that she just didn't know how to be very loving. So my dad was really a genius and good at everything. He could play any instrument. He had an unbelievable memory. He was an excellent diagnostician way before computers. And, and so it was very hard to compete in that atmosphere because what was rewarded was what you accomplished. Mm-hmm. So I didn't grow up with a feeling of intrinsic worth, that I was a good person, even if I made mistakes. And so it was I had a difficult childhood, and
would you say that your parents' parenting ability, maybe natural abilities or at least style, just didn't work with your personality as a child?
I think that's not hits you, it right on the head.
You would have.
I was very sensitive.
Yes.
And my sister was more of a rebellion, daring to rebel. And so I took all that to heart and felt like I had to be perfect. And that put a lot of pressure on me.
Where would you say your natural personality would be that you would have thrived better in just sort of a warm hugs and kisses, rich, you know, non-judgmental kind of household?
Yes, non-judgmental. Very good, not judgmental.
Let's move on. You met my father, Sandy, when you were both teenagers, I think.
I was 14, he was 15. We were at a Halloween party.
Yeah.
He was very shy, and I saw him sitting on the staircase, and I went over and talked to him, and we ended up dancing cheek to cheek that very night.
Huh.
Which was actually a new experience for both of us. And after that, he did not go. I went to an all-girls school called Beaver Country Day School in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And he went to a college prep school, so he wasn't around all the time. But we did become boyfriend and girlfriend. And by 16, we pretty much had agreed to get married when we grew up.
Wow. So that was really young, well before college.
Yes.
I'll come back to that, but...
I never dated anyone else.
Okay. I'll come back to that, but you went to college at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He kind of followed you down there, and my understanding is just tried to get to any college he possibly could that was somewhere nearby. You were a better student than he was. And
yes.
So he went to Elon College nearby. But you were both in college, and let's focus on your time at Duke, right in the early to mid-60s, I think.
Yes.
What was that like?
In the Beatles.
In the South, given that you grew up in the North.
Interesting. It was during the Beatles craze and during the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I had grown up in pretty much a white middle to upper class area.
Mm-hmm.
And... had never really had much contact with African Americans, and yet the North purported, is that a word, to be integrated.
Yeah.
But at that time, there were no black students at my school.
Yeah.
There were no black students that you saw at the shopping center.
Yeah.
So. I really chose Duke because I was the second person from my school ever to go there. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts is full of really good colleges and universities, and many, many people don't even bother to go out of state.
Right.
My parents wanted me close to home. I wanted to be as far away as possible. Duke is 751 miles away from where I grew up.
Wow, you still remember that number.
We went there to look at it during a snowstorm with chains through New Jersey. And when we got there, the grass was green and birds were pulling worms. And the chapel, I grew up Episcopalian, and the chapel at Duke is gorgeous. And I drove up there and said, this is the college for me. But I was amazed when you went shopping, I would hold the door open for African American people. And they would look at me a little strangely, but we would go into a department store like Macy's or Belk's. They didn't have Macy's down there, but they had one called Belk, Belk Leggett.
Yep.
And so we were much more with African American people in the South than we ever were in the North. And I found that very strange, where they were supposed to be segregated and we weren't. Duke University is a very, it has students from all over the world and from every state in the union.
Yeah.
So, you know, unlike the North Carolina State University or the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where practically everybody is from North Carolina.
Right.
I don't remember, there were people from foreign countries as students, And there were probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there were African-American students there at the time, because Duke was very progressive.
Yes.
But the what shocked me the most was in the community, we shopped with African-Americans and, you know, rode on the bus with them and...
Yeah, so issues of segregation and culture were jarring to you, having grown up in Massachusetts and moving to North Carolina for college. You know, maybe people in Massachusetts claim that they were integrated, but there just weren't any African-Americans. And so, you know, if there were, sure, they'd be integrated, but there weren't. Whereas in North Carolina...
Well, they were there, but they all lived in Roxbury.
So they really were segregated.
They really were segregated.
Yeah. Of course, the South was segregated too, to a large extent. I think during, I mean, this was the time of, you know, of, I mean, this was just post Montgomery bus, you know.
But do you remember the date of the Greensboro sit-in?
I don't.
I know the date.
We visited a museum there.
I know the date that Kennedy got shot. That was November 22nd, 1963, because I was a sophomore.
Okay.
And I remember, I can't remember how I found out that happened, but I was outside near the tennis court, and we all loved Kennedy, and we were just horrified. When you know that Lincoln was shot, but it wasn't. Like, assassinations happened in other countries, not in America.
Yeah.
And I remember just sitting down just outside the tennis court in the grass and just crying my head off. I was in college near the time of the Greensboro sit-in because my roommate... demonstrated in downtown Durham during Martin Luther King's call for passive resistance, where you did not help the police at all. You let them drag you to jail.
Right.
My roommate went, and she was in jail overnight. And I didn't go because I knew that if I got put in jail, that my parents would not send me the money for college.
Interesting.
So I had to make a choice. I believed in it, and I would have done it, but I would have stopped my college education right there. Even though the money for my college came from my grandfather, not from my parents. My parents had complete control over it.
Right.
And I just knew that if I got arrested in the civil rights movement and put in jail, that the hammer would come down.
They were not activists, let's say.
No.
Okay. That's fascinating. Let me continue to move on. We have a lot still of your life to talk about. You ultimately had three children together with my dad.
Yes.
How did being a parent change you?
I don't think it did.
Okay.
I was the...
natural born parent?
Well...
Mom?
I think so. My... first of all, I was a school teacher... So I loved kids. I was teaching school, high school actually, before you were conceived. And interesting enough, you probably don't know this, there was a rule that if you got pregnant, you could not teach after 5 months. They would not allow you in the classroom.
Protect the delicate young mind,
yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, totally crazy. And so 5 months pregnant with you, I had to stop my job. And I had taught for maybe, 66, 67 into 68, because you were born in September. So that spring, I had to stop teaching. I've been teaching for maybe 2.5 years. And I knew my ideas of what bad parenting was from my own childhood.
Okay.
And so I was a nurturer by nature, a lover of children and animals. And yes, I hadn't done a lot of babysitting when I was growing up. My sister was the babysitter. I think it just came naturally to me. Interesting, another time period. you were born in 68, and Woodstock was in 1969. And if I hadn't had you, I would have been at Woodstock.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't believe in the total free love or free sex, whatever you want to call it. But I did believe wholeheartedly in taking people for who they were, not what they looked like, mm-hmm. for the whole idea of the love generation.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't had a baby, I would have been in Woodstock.
Would Dad have gone with you?
Don't know. Probably.
Yeah.
Could be.
Was he politically aligned in your thinking at the time, or was he just sort of along for the ride?
Probably along for the ride.
Okay. You were leading the political charge of the two of you.
My heart was in the right place, put it that way.
So your marriage to Dad didn't work out. And I know this was a difficult time for you. How did you make it through that?
I cried for a long time. Mm-hmm. Your dad was the only man that I had really known. I went to an all-girls school for junior high and high school. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason I chose Duke, was because it was co-ed. Mm-hmm. Whereas my parents wanted me to go to an all-girls school. Mm-hmm. But I never had a lot of male friends. Mm-hmm. So the divorce was devastating in that I just felt like I had the rug pulled out from underneath me. And you have to realize I had never lived on my own. I think one of my regrets was after I got married my junior year in college, after my junior year. So I never went to a town and had an apartment and made my own money and taught school and knew that I could support myself.
Were many students, friends of yours, classmates getting married before finishing undergrad at that time?
No.
Okay, so that was early. Nope.
My roommate did, but that was only because she got pregnant first and then she got married.
Okay.
And she had to leave school because she was pregnant. Hmm. So, you know, you couldn't be pregnant and go to the university.
As a matter of policy.
Yes. Is that not just amazing?
Wow.
You couldn't wear pants to class. So, you had to wear dresses or skirts to class.
Wow.
So it was a very different culture.
Very
different time.
Yeah, very different.
So
what got you through the divorce?
Yeah,
or what
I was
got
getting
you
to there.
Emotionally through it?
I think grit, determination, and the fact that I was responsible for you three kids. And so I couldn't take any time off. Mm. You know, everybody needed breakfast. Mm. But I did sort of set my own independence. I had never been allowed to get my ears pierced because your dad didn't like that. So I immediately got my ears pierced. Mm. We had a dog that he gave me when I was 16 that died, sadly. And he would never let us have another dog.
What was that dog's name?
David.
What kind of dog?
German Shepherd.
Okay.
He died just before you were born.
Okay. Very vague memory of that story.
So, and you were 9 about when we got divorced. So for 9 years, we were not allowed to have a dog.
Yeah.
So I got my ears pierced. Mm. I got a dog. And I took you to the beach. And those were the three things.
Okay.
We lived in North Carolina that has some of the most beautiful beaches.
Right.
And he would never take us to the beach.
Right. Was that Rebel or was that another dog that I'm not?
That was Rebel.
Okay.
Our family dog.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
So you kind of touched on it, but I was going to ask, what lessons, life lessons, do you take away from that time getting through and over the divorce?
I think it's really important for people to get out on their own before they get married and realize that they can take care of themselves. Mm. I really regret that. That would be the biggest lesson.
Yeah. Okay.
Just that you know that you can have a career, that you can support yourself, and you know that you don't always need to be taken care of by somebody else.
Okay. I know that Melvin, your second husband, meant a great deal to you.
Yes.
He was also a good deal older than you. 20 years or more? Something like that.
18,
what was your,
I think.
What was your favorite memory of a time with him?
I just wrote a story about that for a writing class that I'm taking.
Huh.
One of my favorite times was when he took us to the beach at Nag's Head, which is near Kitty Hawk in North Carolina, because after I got married the second time, we still lived in North Carolina. And he took us on the ferry boat and taught us how to throw bread up to little balls of bread up to the seagulls. And we flew kites and fished. In fact, he and I went on a few fishing trips, and those are really good memories. Also, able to grew up on a lake in New Hampshire, Lake Winnipesaukee.
Yeah.
And he was in the Navy, so he wasn't a good swimmer, but he learned how to save himself. And one of my favorite things was to take him back to my childhood island on Winnipesaukee and share that with him.
Yeah. What was one of the most difficult times with him?
Melvin was a saver.
Mm.
He wasn't a hoarder, but he hardly ever threw anything away.
Mm-hmm.
So we built our own house, and he moved all his stuff into the basement and filled it completely up.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came time to move my stuff in, there was no more room.
Mm-hmm.
And all around our property were little piles of things that he might need, whether it be cement blocks or boxes of screws or coffee cans of things or oil cans. So that was probably... I can only remember two bad days in 18 years of marriage to him. So, but I remember those distinctly. But probably our biggest problem was dealing with the stuff.
Okay. Well, that's not as bad, really, probably in perspective as some people's marriages.
No, he was warm to my friends. He was kind. Religious. We had a wonderful marriage. And as I say, two bad days in 18 years.
So he's been gone for quite some time now.
Since 2001.
Speaking of that, you give yourself a day of remembrance, I guess we'll call it. It's every year on the day he died. My question for you is, why did you choose to remember him especially on the day he died and not his birthday or the day you were married or some other special day?
This may sound corny, but the world stopped on the day he died for me. His two daughters and my daughter and I were all there when he died in the hospital from pneumonia, of all things. You don't think of people dying of pneumonia these days, but that's what he died of.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a heart patient for 12 years, but he did not die of a heart problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like in order to appreciate the life that we had together, I needed to stop and just take some time out. So he died on August 23rd of 2001, just before 9/11. I was actually very grateful that in a strange way that he died before 9/11, because that would have upset him very much.
I can imagine.
Having
been in the Navy, I remember
severely.
Him, at least one part of his person being very much a patriot.
Yes. Yes, it would have really...
I can imagine that would have... Yeah.
He would have considered it Armageddon.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Even in a biblical sense.
I can imagine that, yeah.
So, especially in the early years, I would take a trip to the Blue Ridge Mountains for mm-hmm. 2 or 3 days. I would go on a meditation retreat for 2 or 3 days. I would take flowers and... and sometimes write.
Uh-huh.
stories about times that we had together, and just took some time off. His birthday was the 22nd of December, so that's so near Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, it just, that wasn't appropriate.
Okay.
And, I mean, I do remember the day we were married, but for some reason, I just felt like, even though it wasn't to remember his death, it was to remember the good times that we had together. And
to take a moment to stop.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just to take, as it stopped that that first time.
Yes.
Okay. That makes a lot more sense now. I'd always wondered that, actually. Here's a speculative question for you. Let's move on to some, to the last few couple of things. You've been a grandma now for over, well, almost 20 years, I guess.
That's
right.
Connor
turned 20. Yeah. For just over 20 years by a few weeks. What do you imagine being a great grandma would be like?
I would so love to live long enough to see these children, meaning my grandchildren, grow up, get married, and have a great grandchild would just please me no end. I love being a grandmother. I love it more than being a parent. I can spoil them, and then I can send them home. And I'm not responsible for how they turn out, but my goal is to let all my grandchildren know that they can always come to me, that the door is always open, that they will always be received no matter what they've done, unconditionally. And I don't feel that I grew up with unconditional love, and I want to pass that on to my grandchildren very, very much.
And your great-grandchildren?
Yes, and my great-grandchildren. I would really, I'm trying to stay really healthy, despite some health problems, so that I can live long enough to actually have that happen.
Awesome. I hope that happens. Taking a step back from, you know, your immediate family, and what do you think in the world that the future holds for your children and your grandchildren and great-grandchildren after you're gone? Are you generally optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
I used to be a problem solver.
Uh-huh.
Very optimistic. Just give me a problem, I will solve it.
Mm-hmm.
You need poster paper for your project and it's due tomorrow and the drugstore is only open for five more minutes, we are going to get there. Uh-huh. And we're going to get that poster board.
Right.
And that's a true story.
I remember multiple incidences like that.
But as I've grown older, I have become sadly more of a pessimist. I'm really worried about the quality of our water. We just lived through the worst fire California has ever had, with the most deaths.
The campfire.
The campfire, 2018. And the air quality was 260, which is dangerous to breathe. And it finally rained, and the next day after it rained, the air quality was 6.
Yeah.
It went from 260 to 6. And I have asthma, as did my dad. So I experienced what it's like to try to live in bad air. And the oil spills, climate change, the responses of our government to those things that we are now out of the Paris Accord only with Syria.
Do you think you're...
Though I have to say I'm pessimistic about not only the future of my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but the planet.
I wonder if you rewind, I wonder if you have any opinion about this, if you rewind to the 1940s, 1950s, I don't know what memory you have, but you could even speculate on, do you think that your parents, if asked that question in the 50s and 60s maybe, about their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, do you think they would have thought it was optimistic or pessimistic?
I think they would have thought it was optimistic, because the Eisenhower era, after World War II, we really didn't think there'd be a World War III.
Yeah.
We thought we were done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a time when communications were coming in, television was coming in, you know, things, people had jobs, compared to the Theodore Roosevelt, you know, bucket of chicken or whatever that is, you know, wasn't there something about a bucket of chicken?
I don't know, probably.
Okay. but, you know, those were good times.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think our politicians were more respected and more respectable.
Mm.
And so I have to say that I do what I can to support preserving the rainforest. When I decide what to give to, it usually has to do with planetary health or poverty.
Uh-huh.
To erase poverty or to keep the rainforest from being cut down. Because climate change is no joke to me. It is real and it's happening. You know, we could literally be living in a desert.
Mm.
The jet stream has changed. I mean, the evidence is there. So
those are your concerns for the future.
I'm not that optimistic.
World
population, you know, the fact that people were afraid to go to the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro because the air quality, and the same with Asia.
Yep.
I watched pro tennis all the time, and long-term, 40-year-old tennis players chose not to go to Brazil because of the air quality.
Yeah.
Not because they were afraid they would be shot or something.
Yeah.
And the same thing with parts of Asia.
Yeah.
I think mostly China.
Let's say in a sentence or two, how will people remember you?
I hope that they'll remember me as a kind, loving person. That's who I want to be. That's who I hope I am. I opened my door to refugees from an earlier fire a year ago and had, at least three dogs and five extra people in my three-bedroom house. And and many, many, many Thanksgivings so that my children could travel. I kept all the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, you know, I don't really care if I'm remembered for my intellect, although I think I have one. Just as a kind, loving person.
Yeah, I
that unconditional love that I spoke about.
I would have added to that generous. I've always I think that's probably one of my main traits that I think about you. When I think about you is your generosity, and you're talking about opening your house to refugees and taking care of the animals, and you've always helped us when we needed it, even if it wasn't particularly to your benefit. For instance, like you said, if children were leaving to go somewhere, you'd stay, but, you know, help and take care of things, children or animals.
Right.
Last two little thoughts, and we'll make these short. We're almost done here. Is there anything you've never told me but want to tell me now? Maybe not. You're pretty open and honest and generous. It's fine if it's not.
Hmm.
Or even if it's small.
Well, if you're talking about just you.
Sure.
You were born on the second day with auricular tachycardia.
Right.
Heartbeat over 200, and you were on digoxin for a year, and you were, they told us as brand new parents, you talked about parenting, we were brand new parents, that not to let you cry too long, and to be really careful if you got a high fever, that it might come back.
Let me stop you there for a second, because I know those things. You've told me that.
Oh.
But let me...
I told you about the biggest argument your father and I ever had?
No, tell me that. Okay. That's something I don't know.
Okay. So you were very, very persistent at a very young age. At 10 months, you could stand on the arm of the couch and turn the light switch on and off. And you would jump in your bed so hard you would actually come out of the crib and land on the kitchen floor. Uh-huh. We were living in a one-bedroom house, so you slept in the kitchen, in your crib. But I taught you, your father was away a lot, flying his plane for his job, and I taught you finally to go to bed and cry yourself to sleep. And he came back home, and I put you to bed, and I knew you would cry for only like 2 or 3 minutes.
Yep.
And you would go to sleep.
Yep.
Where you used to cry for like 45 minutes.
Yep.
And... he got very upset. He was afraid that you were going to get sick.
Oh, because of the heart problem.
Yes, and he said, if he dies, it's my fault.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh my gosh. Wash my hands of it.
Wow.
And I said,
no, I didn't know
he's
that.
Only going to cry for 2 or 3 minutes.
You had it down.
You know, because I had trained you while he was gone.
You've been home, yeah, right.
Yes.
Right. Wow, okay. That is definitely something I didn't know.
So your life was in my hands.
Wow. Last question. We have less than 3 minutes. Is there anything about me that you've always wanted to know but never asked? And again, it's okay if there's nothing in particular.
Well, let's see. I know about the tequila incident.
Uh oh.
Let's see. Well, did you ever take drugs? Like drug like LSD or?
Nope. I've certainly smoked marijuana. Just a couple of times in college. I didn't like it at the time, although I definitely tried it. And I sort of didn't do it too much more. As an adult, again, like so 20 years plus went by. As adult, in the last 5 to 10 years, I've tried it again and really didn't like it again.
What did it
become,
do to you?
It's become really ubiquitous in California, as you know. So, yeah. You know, it's sort of almost hard to avoid. Tried it again, really didn't like it. It messes with my sense of like time and space, kind of. Not like a psychedelic, but like just I feel like I'm out of touch with reality around me, and that is really discomforting.
Bad feeling.
I just don't. Yeah, it's not bad, like, just arbitrary, emotionally bad feeling. It's like, specifically being out of control, and that's not something I like.
Yeah. I've never tried it, so I could be president.
I'm sure you could be president anyway.
I haven't ever tried
it. That's a good question, though. So.
But I was just interested.
Yeah, so, yes, but without any kind of pattern.
Yeah.
All right.
That's
well,
good.
Mom, thanks.
I love you anyway.
I love you. I love you too. Give me a hug on audio recording here.
Okay, hug, family hug.
Okay, thank you.